to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
September is National Recovery Month, and with recent headlines about relapse back in the news, we wanted to tackle a topic that doesn't get talked about enough, the shame that can follow a setback in recovery.
Dr. Frank Spinelli is our guest. He's a physician, certified health coach, and author of the new book, The Shame Compass: A Radical Framework for Trauma Healing and Self-Acceptance. During the pandemic, he was a high-functioning doctor privately struggling with alcohol and unresolved trauma. It was an experience that led him to develop the Compass framework for understanding shame and behavioral change.
Today, he coaches clients through the Reframe platform, helping people respond to relapse with self-awareness instead of self-punishment. Please welcome Dr. Frank Spinelli.
Well, thank you for having me. Great introduction.
Well, let's jump right in. I think for a lot of folks, the idea of recovery is very attached to 12-step programs and maybe people that they know who have had abuse disorders, who they quit, and then if they're successful, that's the end of it. There's nothing ever that happens again, doesn't come up again. Can you guide us through what you tend to see more realistically for people?
I think it's you're absolutely right in the way you described it. We tend to believe that recovery is a binary. You're either sober or you're not. And AA and the 12 steps have worked for probably millions of people. So I'm not here to talk about whether or not I agree with it. I think whatever works for you is something I support. What I found in myself and working with clients at Reframe over the years is that people want to feel empowered, not powerless. They want information. So when you understand the science behind it, it doesn't seem like a moral failing. It's neuroscience. Your brain has been rewired to want alcohol. It's an addiction. And so if you understand the steps to undo that, then quite possibly you can become sober if that's what you want, or sober curious, or mindfully moderating. I think people want choices. And if we learned anything from the research, it's that younger people, Gen Zers, are not attached to alcohol like maybe their parents or their grandparents. And they certainly don't feel it's an all or nothing situation. So they're empowered to understand what is the science, what is alcohol actually really doing to your brain and the rest of your body. And I think only then can you understand what recovery could be for you.
Yeah. Well, if you're a person who has never had an issue, never had this kind of draw that feels so compulsive, can you describe what happens in the body, in the mind of an addict or a person with abuse disorder tendencies that you might not understand as a person who's not experienced that?
Well, you only have to look at me for the example. I never had an issue with alcohol. In fact, I grew up with Italian parents from Italy. There was wine in the house. Certainly, they drank wine every night. This was back in the day when we were saying one or two glasses is actually good for you. Now we know the World Health Organization has come out and said zero alcohol is really the recommendation because it's a carcinogenic and has untoward effects on your heart. So it only takes something like a global pandemic where we're all living in isolation, we're all concerned, scared, or you're going through something like I was going through, which I was made to fill out a questionnaire in an ongoing litigation with the Boy Scouts of America. And I felt like I was just drinking to get by every day. And the next thing I knew, I was looking in the mirror and I said, this is not what I want. This is not who I am. So certainly if you're listening to this, you don't have to be this stereotype of someone who cannot function without starting the day off with drinking. I think the best way to understand whether or not you have a problem is to ask yourself, am I happy with my relationship with alcohol? Is it leading me or am I controlling it? And if you find that you're unhappy, you're dissatisfied, you feel you want more, then yeah, you probably should really reevaluate. And that's why I like Reframe, because it really is about negotiating the relationship you want with alcohol so that it's no longer front and center. In fact, when I work with clients, I feel like we've gotten to a good place where we're no longer talking about alcohol, where we've relegated it to the side and you're making decisions because you would feel informed and empowered. So don't necessarily think you have to be Nicolas Cage in that very famous movie where he played an alcoholic. You don't have to be that extreme. You could just be somebody who drinks one or two a night and just doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Spinelli, I'm wondering, I mean, so far you've been talking about alcohol addiction, mm-hmm. but yeah. there are really so many types of
Absolutely.
Addiction and then shame that is linked to finding yourself relapsing or coming back into the same situation. And it could be with food, it could be with mm-hmm. getting ourselves back into the same pattern of a relationship or something like that. Which addictions are really the hardest to get over? Or is it about the addiction or what led us to the addiction in the first place?
Yeah, that's very good. Very good question. So for a lot of people, we've had childhood traumas, whether you were abused or sexually abused or neglected, and that could have very long-term effects as an adult if they're not addressed. And even when they are, they can bubble up to the surface, like during a global pandemic, where what happened? Millions of people reached for alcohol. But you bring up a very good point, which is that we rely on substances like drugs, like alcohol, like sex, like food, to quell that voice in our head. And I bring up this voice because I feel shame often comes about because it's this unreliable narrator that speaks to you in your head. And when I work with clients about whatever trauma they had, and by the way, it doesn't necessarily have to be childhood trauma. You could have a very bad breakup, a divorce. You could have gotten laid off, and it really impacts people. And that's why they, again, reach for something to quell that voice, because they think, and this is a myth, that if they use a substance, they will quiet that voice, when we know you won't. And the fact of the matter is that voice is not your own. It's someone else's who installed it in you when you were either a young or a child, or you were younger, or perhaps a child or an adult when you were traumatized and you didn't have the language to say, no, that's not true. So the hope is that when I work with people, it's we do an exercise where we try to map whose voice that is. Like, for example, I could leave here today and say all of a sudden in my head, say, oh, that you did a terrible job. Wow, what you really blew that. Now, me having worked through the framework can say, wait a minute. I remember the interview. It kind of went well. I enjoyed talking to those individuals and we had a really good conversation. So it's about learning shame literacy and being able to understand what are the thoughts that are in your head and what are the facts. And once you can do that, and it does take time, you can understand the context of why you're reaching for drugs or alcohol or sex or food.
Mm. So interesting that this really is a conversation more about shame than it is about addiction. Why is shame so powerful in addiction? Why does it keep us coming back?
Well, it's complicated. So the first thing you have to know is what's the difference between guilt and shame. And people get them confused because we use them interchangeably. But guilt is, for example, I did something bad and I feel badly about it. It's behavioral and you could actually learn from it. You could say, oh, I'm sorry, I did that. I'm going to apologize. Shame is I'm bad. It's identity. It's that voice that tells you, I knew you were going to screw this up. You always do this. And this is why bad things happen to you. And that's a shame spiral. And when we have tendency towards addiction, any type of relapse or any type of misuse or slip ups, we immediately say, see, I knew you couldn't do this. It becomes a cycle and you perpetuate it with this awful feeling that you carry with you. And I think so often with shame, one of the things we do, and I was guilty of this having gone through therapy for years, is that we think we're going to outrun shame or we're going to suppress it. Well, spoiler alert, you can't. Shame is an emotion. It's like saying, oh, stop being happy. It's just not going to happen. Shame is attached to some biological functions. And if you think of it this way, Shame is like a beach ball, right? You can suppress it underwater, right? It takes effort, but what happens? Someone will say something to you at work and you'll snap. And what happens? It explodes through the water so that your reaction to the situation is disproportionate to what happened. And so often we feel that we have to outrun shame. And what I teach in the book is, what if we just leaned into it? What if we listen to the voice and see where it's pointing us towards, or perhaps what is it protecting us from?
That brings up an interesting element. Earlier, you were mentioning that part of the reason people turn to addictive behaviors is avoidance. Maybe they don't want to feel something. They don't want to deal with something, whatever. And I'm wondering if those same people will be able to not avoid looking at this tricky part, as you're suggesting. Like, how can we support somebody through their process of even being able to examine themselves honestly and fairly if there is a repeated pattern of avoidance?
Well, that's the key, isn't it? Fortunately, when people come to me as clients, they've already made the choice. They want something better. And one of the things that I talk about constantly is the desire for better is the transition from victimhood into survivor. Not everybody who's a victim of something becomes a survivor of it. You have to want that desire. It's not just having lived. It's about wanting to be better, wanting to improve your life. And so the first C, the first letter in the Compass framework is C. It's confront. Are you willing to confront what it is you feel most shameful about? And it really is about when you experience shame, and this could take you 60 seconds, is when you experience shame next time, sit with it. Don't judge yourself and say, what's going on? Oh, I'm feeling flushed. I'm feeling pressure in my chest. Okay, what if we just sat with it for 60 seconds and not judged it? That is the first step. All too often, what do? We want to quiet that. So we reach for something. And whatever that substance is or behavior is, that's really where we go wrong, because we're not suppressing it. We're just perpetuating it. So yeah, to answer your question, you have to want to actually examine and do this with mindfulness and self-compassion and understanding that you're not alone.
Well, what I love about that is that you have to get to that point to want to recover at all. So this, what you're talking about is this new framework of coming at it with more awareness. Would you mind going through the other letters in the acronym COMPASS of the framework to explain it?
So it's the COMPASS framework. And if you just go down the line, so C is confronting it. And I just gave you a very simple definition. And O is observing it. Observe it as if you're a scientist and you're examining something. And just observe what is the behavior attached to it. M is mapping it back. Now, often we don't have to do a full deep dive. And if you want to, then I suggest you get a good therapist and accompany you with the book. But the mapping exercise is to understand who is that voice. Now, for my example, I knew clearly who this was. This was the man who molested me when I was 11 years old. And whenever I was triggered, that was a variation on that person. And then P is processing this. And going through the process is understanding what relationship you have, or what is the story you're telling? What is the relationship you have with others that brings this up? And it really helps set the stage of how you're going to work through this, because oftentimes the brain and the body are working, but one lags behind the other. And there is a lot of great literature that we hold trauma in our bodies, physically, in our bodies, in our chemistry. So it's important to understand the process.
The body keeps the score.
I was going to say, if you haven't read it, you should. And then A is acceptance and learning that you have to integrate it. I'm really very sorry to have to tell you this, but it's also something positive. This is not going to go away. However, you will be able to move through this in a way where it becomes less impactful on your daily life. And you can do that through integration, not denying it, which is what a lot of people want to do, but integrating it and accepting that this is part of your story and part of your DNA. And hopefully that will help you move through it and learn to live a better life. And then S is sustaining it through shame literacy. Again, being able to understand what that voice is telling you, when these situations are arising, and how better for you to react. Oftentimes, I teach this 4P thing. Your superpower is pausing. And so the next time somebody activates you, what do? You immediately snap. The balloon, the beach ball comes bursting through the water. But if you could only take a few seconds to not react. And the way I teach this is, next time you're talking to your best friend and they stop talking, don't answer. Wait 3 seconds. It teaches them that you're listening. And it actually also tells your brain, oh, Frank's going to respond. He's not going to let shame kick in. And then finally, the last S I say is optional, but I think it's probably very important if you want to, is the service. So if you're able to share your story like I'm doing here, this is a transactional relationship. Hopefully you're learning something and I'm getting something back in validation. And we do this a lot in community meetings where I ask people, you know, consider sharing your story as a way of connecting with the community. Because why? And I wish I had said this, but I didn't, so I'm only going to repeat it based on the research, is that shame breeds in isolation. The only antidote to shame is community, so coming together. And so if you can do that, you will be hopefully better off for it.
Wow. Putting the pieces of your personal experience together, Frank, you had this experience of being molested when you were 11. You didn't have to sort of bring it back to the forefront until much later, when it also coincided with when we were more in isolation during that pandemic. So you went all of these years where that trauma and whatever resulting shame was just kind of under the surface. Is that right? And so how do you think that the isolation of the pandemic, you know, really, because it did affect so many people, how is that all put together?
So again, 11 to 13, molested, grew out of it, not really struggling as a young adult, found this wonderful art therapist, amazing person, saved my life. And lo and behold, I become a doctor. I'm a success. And then came about a very traumatizing event where I learned by accident that the man who molested me had adopted 15 boys because they didn't they shamed my parents into keeping quiet. They told us he'll step down, Frank will go back to normal. And unfortunately, this is one of the major gaps in the system. So I learned this, and I work with the police. I wore a wiretap. I mean, I'm Frank Spinelli from Staten Island. I'm wearing a wiretap. And, you know, lucky for me, it all worked out. The police in New York did a sensational job, and we brought him to justice. And so you would have thought I had put I had closed the book on this whole experience of my life. Well, that's where I went wrong. And I worked with many great therapists. And I, again, was married and happy and working and very successful. But I think always, like you just described, below the surface was this experience with shame. And I think it showed up in odd ways that I had just learned to manage because I was also a healthcare provider. But I think it was during the pandemic. Well, not I thought. It was during the pandemic lockdown, where simultaneously we're all in isolation. And then I'm filling out this 47-page questionnaire and recounting graphic details. And I don't remember. I did it blacked out, drunk. And I said to myself, why is this coming up again? I asked that same question you asked. Why? I had figured it all out. And I think that's what I really wanted everyone to know, that, and the reason why writing a book is that you can be a success, you can be happy. When you least expect it, if the shame is not resolved or you are not addressing it in a way that makes you feel like you're living with it and you're shame literate, this will be like a trap door for you. And I'll never forget, I tell the story because it was very funny, but I had this amazing boss. I loved him to death. Very narcissistic, brilliant. And one day he said something to me and I snapped. And I thought to myself, later, wait a minute, why did I react so harshly? And I was like, because you know why? He reminds you of the man who molested you. He was talking to you in a way. And I had to realize then, I'm not 11-year-old Frank. I'm actually an adult physician. And once I made that connection, I said to myself, if I don't do something, this will happen again. And it probably had happened. I just never really thought to explore it, but the pandemic really made it more heightened. And that's when I said something has to change.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story. I'm sure it will make our listeners go back and wonder about these triggers that they have in their lives and things that we all may not have dealt with that could be causing kind of the shame that we have currently, and then how that wraps into addiction. So going back to addiction and asking this question about people who are using substances, how much is it about the substance itself? You know, you mentioned your parents, they had a glass of wine or two every night. Was it about the substance? Was it that they love the taste of alcohol? Or is it that is it what the substance is doing for you? You know, making you escape, making you, you know, quell your anxiety, whatever it is.
Right. I, you know, you bordered on both sides of the spectrum here. So yes, for my parents, it was ingrained in their culture. They drank wine every night. My father made wine. So it was a cultural thing. And I think they just accepted it was one or two. They didn't have any sort of addiction to it. But I do feel we normalize alcohol, especially. It's almost part of our culture. Imagine this. You cannot, in our culture, my Italian culture, we can't cheers you with a glass of water. My mother would be like, oh my God, that's bad luck. It has to be alcohol. We celebrate with alcohol. There is always a reason to drink. I had a good day. I had a bad day. It's Wednesday. I mean, it's so normalized. And I think a lot of people just take that into consideration. Well, I drink only on the weekends, or and it's really not so much about the substance. It is about what you are using it for. So whenever I work with clients and they call me up very depressed, oh, I drank last night, and they feel so defeated. And that's one of the pitfalls in addiction. It's not that you can be sober for 10 days and then that one day you drink, everything gets erased. It's not like that. We say that this is, you know, it's a journey that is linear, but it goes up and down. You're going to have slip ups. The idea is that you want to develop tools that don't prevent you from falling down. You develop tools to get back up. So it's understanding that the next day is another day for you to start over. I think oftentimes many people with addiction feel like it's all or nothing. Well, I had a drink, so now let's go crazy. And that's really the wrong mindset. So again, going back to, I think your original question, it's whenever I work with somebody new, I ask them, all right, you're going to keep a drinking diary, unless they want to be sober right away. And by the way, I want to caveat this. There are some people who should never drink again. There are just some people that should never touch alcohol again. But for people who are working through where they want to be, I tell them to keep a journal about when they drink and why. The context around why you drink is so important. There's a much bigger difference between you invited me to a dinner party and I had a couple of glasses of wine at dinner, as opposed to I was home alone and I was drinking alone, or I was going into the garage and I was secret drinking. You know, you really have to look at the behavior, and not only the behavior, but the context and why you're choosing a substance, and perhaps what are you running away from, or what are you trying to quell that you don't want to address? So again, it not necessarily about the substance, but the behavior behind it.
Most of us have people that we've loved who have faced this challenge. And one of the things that's hard for a person watching someone working through recovery is that feeling that they need to rebuild trust because they maybe have made some mistakes along their path and let down some folks. And to try to stay supportive, it's a challenge when slips happen. You draw an excellent distinction between accountability and shame after that setback. What does the difference look like in practice? And how can you hold someone accountable without slipping into shame or guilt?
Right. It's another double-edged sword, isn't it?
It's a hard one.
I mean, you know, I think families and friends, for the most part, really are rooting for you. You know, they want to see you succeed. I think the pitfall for a lot of friends and family is that they're tired, or they've seen this before, or they're trying to trust you. And it is very difficult on both sides. I think one of the most important things is that we say we meet people where they are. Here's where they are. And we support them. We do so in a non-judgmental way. We have clear boundaries. I think a lot of people blur that line, and that's where family and friends go wrong, where they tend to not want to look, or because they feel that they're going to shame you. But there's nothing wrong with saying, I love you, and I'm just a little concerned, and can we talk about this? Bring it up in a way that doesn't feel like you're attacking them or judging them, but you just want to, you're coming from a place of curiosity. That's the best thing. The other thing about for the person who is struggling the most is to understand that what you're doing is you're holding yourself accountable. So I say, Mary, I'm coming to your party tonight, but I'm only going to drink two drinks. I don't expect you to parent me, but I'm holding myself accountable that when I say that, this is what I'm going to do. Now, if you have three or four the next day to realize, okay, I'm here. I'm choosing not to continue drinking. I'm not doing the all in or all of nothing. You know, it's whenever someone comes to me and they said, I drank last night, and I feel really bad about it. Okay, you did. Now, what are you doing today? How are you showing up today? I'm not going to drink. Great. I'm going to practice self-care. Good. I'm going to practice self-compassion. Okay, that's great. It's the difference between falling down a shame spiral and getting back up and just saying, okay, what happened yesterday happened, and I'm going to move forward. Now, where it gets complicated is when you make too many promises you can't keep. And that really is where I think family and friends need to draw a line and say, listen, I'm not going to enable you anymore. And if you don't make substantial changes, I don't know how I can be a part of your life.
Yeah.
Tough.
It's a challenging situation for everybody involved, but luckily we have some new frameworks to work with and new ways of looking at a complex situation. We've been talking with Dr. Frank Spinelli. He's the author of a new book called The Shame Compass, a radical framework for trauma healing and self-acceptance. Thank you, Doctor, for being with us this morning on the Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.